Hello and welcome to IVA On Industry Matters, a podcast where we spotlight pressing issues facing advertising today. Hello and welcome to IVA On Industry Matters. Today we have David Adamson and Russ Greenbridge and here to discuss ERGs, so employee resource groups. These can be defined by a group of people within an organisation who voluntarily join together based on shared identity, values, interests, perspective, or goals. But I'd love to hear about both of your opinions when we get into the podcast and how you define an ERG. But over to you both to introduce yourselves.
Do you want to go first?
Oh yeah, so hi, my name is Russ Greenbridge. I've been at RAP now for about 10 years and sounds very grand title, but I'm a vice president for data and analytics.
Hi, I'm David. I feel like a shameless intruder whenever I have these conversations about ERGs because I don't work in people or talent or DEI or anything like that. Much like you, Russell.
No,
I'm a strategist at the AND Partnership.
So as I said in the introduction, I'd love to get your opinions on how you define an ERG, because I know a lot of agencies are setting them up, and I think everyone has their own kind of definition. So I'd love to go over to you.
Yeah, so ERGs, it was actually a term that I wasn't familiar with until I was actually asked to join one and lead one. But I think for me, the key letter is kind of the E in there. So, you know, the E for employee and the fact that for us, it is a group led by employees for the benefit of employees. So I think traditionally a lot of the initiatives that the ERGs do now, I think would have been probably led by the HR teams. So, but in our case, you know, and certainly in the case of the parenting group, it's 80 employees, all parents or parents to be. We span the entire parenting journey. We come from different backgrounds, different departments, work on different clients. So it's very diverse in that respect as well. But effectively, our role is kind of to collaborate and to make RAP a better and more inclusive place to work.
Mm-hmm. And what employee resource group were you asked to lead?
The parents and carers.
So you were scouted.
I was scouted. Yeah, I'll come on to that in the unless you want to touch on that now, but
no,
it's a
we'll
good
get
story.
Into that. And David, I guess, how would you describe ERGs? Or I know you don't like the term ERGs.
really having an issue with the term ERG. But, I mean, how would I define an ERG? So first and foremost, as a community for building a sense of belonging in the workplace amongst a group of people who have shared experiences or identities. So for example, people who are LGBTQIA, like myself. And that's what I can speak from and bring to this conversation as somebody who, you know, works in agencies, has experience leading that kind of community. In terms of the purpose of ERGs, like I said, I struggle with the term ERG because it sounds pretty corporate and really we're talking about people. Mm-hmm. I prefer talking about them as communities. I think the way that companies view employee communities has evolved a lot actually over the last few years. Mm-hmm. I think companies are realizing that some people, many people, perhaps from minority audiences in particular, are going to want to raise their voices louder than perhaps they would have done several years ago in the workplace, particularly I think in the creative industries as well, bring their personal identities and experience mm-hmm. to work and perhaps to even embody in the work that they're creating within agencies. And I think companies are realizing that if they create an environment where people can do that, mm-hmm. and employee community groups are one of those ways that they can help that, it improves things like retention and the recruitment of diverse talent. The other thing I think is happening is an effort to tie employee community groups seamlessly back to business goals. And I think, yeah, there's some logic to that, and that these communities do need to be managed and resourced properly so their presence is really seen and felt by people who work within agencies. But it's important that employees who are part of those communities know that they aren't there to fulfill any business purpose other than to help other people like them feel a sense of belonging and feel welcome. I think that, for me, is the base level of what makes a great employee community, honestly. I think there's fantastic examples of employee communities doing campaign work, consulting with clients, lobbying for policy change, and all of that is brilliant. Mm. But as long as it's built on a pure base of we're here to create and foster a sense of community amongst certain people within the agency.
I think you bring up a really good point there, and I kind of off the back of that want to know who introduced ERGs or communities to your agencies and how do you encourage people to join them?
Shall I get? We can tag team. So, yeah, like I said, it's actually quite a funny story, I think, how I got into to the EIGs, because they did exist at RAP, but didn't really have much of a profile. So it was actually an ex-colleague of mine. She came back from her second maternity leave. She was having a really tough time returning to work. She had a newborn, but a baby and a toddler as well. And she was struggling. So she asked internally whether there was some form of support for working parents, and the reply was no, we don't have a parents group. We do have a parents one for people that have dogs. So we had something set up for that, and I'm not saying that dogs, those furry little fellas, need some care and support, but I just thought it was interesting how we have something for a certain group, but actually not something for parents. So
did she go to HR or someone else, just out of interest?
I think she just asked around the business, and because I do remember, I think it was probably around the time that it was locked down, when everyone was probably buying puppies, and so we focused very much on this change in lifestyle, and forgot about the parents altogether. But not forget about them. But so she decided that was a catalyst, really. So she decided to set up the parents community. We had worked together previously on the same client, and she kind of drafted me in just to get the sort of father's perspective as well. So she's got younger children, I've got older children. So actually having a pair, a father and a mother, and actually with different age children, was kind of where we wanted to get to. So I think I don't honestly know whether there was a point where we said, we're going to set this up and, we're going to drive recruitment for this.
Yeah.
It kind of came back slightly organically, but I think once we had that starting point, it's kind of just naturally grown. And we've added different kind of EIGs in over, the last sort of 6 to 12 months as well. So it's constantly evolving and growing. So, yeah.
So was it the first... So you said obviously there was the poor...
Poor rent.
Poor rent, right, okay. Oh, poor rent, like a parent poor.
Poor as in a poor, yeah, sorry. I didn't explain that very well.
So I was thinking of Paw Patrol. Anyway, so...
As in Paw Patrol.
Yeah.
If you're not a parent, you might not know that reference.
No.
I have godsons, I get it.
No, I was going to say, so I guess there are a few ERGs already, but was the parent and carers one, was that a catalyst for lots more? And did they become kind of more popular after that?
I think it was a bit of a catalyst. I think before that, we had an LGBTQ plus one. I think we had ARENA, which was around anti-racism.
Mm-hmm.
Then the parents one came about, and subsequently, we've also got one which is around disability and mental health. Mm-hmm. We've got a sustainability one. I think there's a gender-based one as well. So yeah, it kind of has, it's grown. And I think the thing that we're trying to do more of now, and I can kind of talk about this in more detail about later on, but actually try not to think of them as separate groups, because actually you could be across multiple groups. And there was actually a conversation that we were having, I had to skip out so I couldn't attend it, but we have this thing called the Salon, which is basically organized by LGBTQ plus, our guy called John, who does an amazing job there. And actually he was talking about the history of his EIG, but actually then we thought, actually, let's get a perspective from a parent, because you could be parenting, a child LGBTQ plus. You could be, it could be two husbands or two wives or so. So actually this, so we're trying to make it sort of more intersectional in terms of the work that we do, and not just having, groups that only focus on their own people that can identify to that group.
No, that's really interesting. And David, I wanted to ask you as well, I guess, from your agency, how you, I don't know, if did you start Unite? I don't want to say something. And then.
Yes, I did.
You did? Okay, that's good.
How employee communities came to the AM partnership? I kind of want to answer this in two ways, right? One from a broader industry's perspective, and then, from the perspective of my own agency. I mean, the AM partnership's always just had a really fantastic, vibrant culture. It's one of the reasons that I'm still there nearly 6 years later. Like, I love it. Mm. And the people there are brilliant. And there's always been very much a sense of, like, bring yourself to work.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a correlation between the Black Lives Matter movement gaining momentum and the number of employee community groups that started to emerge in the corporate space. I think that is a trend that you will see across the whole industry, and that multiple different people from minority backgrounds wanted to feel seen and heard and represented within the workplace. And I think employee community groups are one way that business leaders saw to kind of encapsulate that as as a commitment to their employees. So I think that, for me, is a really interesting correlation that's happened. I think you fast forward several years later, and what you're seeing now is more deeply ingrained strategy about how to manage and resource and support employee community groups that I don't think has necessarily been there for a while.
Have you found the same, Ross, in terms of kind of funding and popularity and senior people getting involved with it?
Yeah, I think sort of lockdown or just kind of post-lockdown. So I think we're much, you know, I don't know about yourself, Dave, we're in the office a lot more now as well, which I think has helped, because I think actually, you know, when we do organise an event and we have quite a few EIG events, you know, they're well attended now and we get some really kind of good, you know, good, healthy kind of conversations and debates in there as well. So I think it has grown. I think they kind of become a bit more sort of formalised as well now. So we have like a D&I calendar. We know what's happening every month. We have themes for every month. We had themes for every quarter last year, but it's a lot more kind of organised. I think we've now got more budget. I think the SLT certainly see, you know, very supportive of it. I think they see the benefits of it. So, you know, I think, you know, like David is saying about you love working at your company, I love working at RAP, because actually as a parent, I have the effect, it affords me the flexibility that I need, you know, make me want to kind of stay there, because, you know, I think you touched on it, David, it's really important for like staff engagement, motivation and staff retention, particularly like in a parenting perspective as well. People might leave because of the maternity pay or because it's not, it's not a place where, you know, I've worked at other places where it probably wouldn't have worked to be there as a parent. Whereas I think, yeah, so the more they can do, definitely the better.
And I wanted to ask you both if you could take us through your kind of most successful ERGs. So I'll start with you, Ross.
Okay, well, obviously I'm very biased. I think it's the parenting one.
And why is that?
No, I think, joking aside, I think they operate in very different ways. Because I think, actually, if you take the parenting one as an example, we'd estimate that probably a third of the, you know, the employees at RAP are parents. It's somewhere between a quarter and a third. We haven't actually got the exact data on it. But so it's a large group, and it's definitely the largest of all the groups. So, like I said, it kind of operates in a slightly different way. We have had, you know, 80 people that have kind of raised their hand and said, you know, I want to be involved in some capacity or I'm interested in it. So we have a, you know, a Teams channel. That Teams channel, like I said, has subsequently been divided up into, you know, sub-segments. So actually, if there's, you know, if you've got a teenager like myself and you're trying to work out how to get him off his screen or put his mobile phone down, then, you know, you could just post something in the chat. So it has been, I think, it's good in that respect. And I think the other thing that's become really good is that, I think you mentioned it in one of your earlier questions. For me, I mean, the policy change stuff is great. I never thought I'd be doing that when I took on this role. But actually, the thing I love about the parent stuff most is the fact that we've now got, you know, sub-communities, if you like, or just friendships more than anything. So there are probably half a dozen people in the business that I would probably never have, you know, worked with, never come into contact with, but because we all have kids that are teenagers, we can relate to each other. You know, my son has ADHD, so we've got other people that have, you know, children with neurodiverse conditions, and so I've actually just got to know these people really well. And, you know, we just go for a coffee and talk about it and talk about our situations, and I think for me that is great. Like, we had one parent on the group said, you know, really curious to know if there's any other step parents on here, because actually how you manage other people's children is very different to maybe managing or sort of parenting your own. So again, now we've got this nice little, you know, group together of step parents, and they get together. So I think it is that more sort of just the kind of day-to-day sort of personal interactions that I think are
and
really
creating
kind
little
of,
like pockets of communities,
yeah,
and
exactly
different.
Yeah. So that's what I think is really
most successful.
But then I think, like, and David, you'll talk about your ERG, but I just think, like I said, the other ones just operate in quite a different way, so it's quite hard to compare them.
Yeah, I can jump in on that point. I think that they are all incredibly different. So when you're trying to kind of define, you know, what's the most successful, I think what's really brilliant is that, like, they all just really want different things, so you can't compare them one against the other. I mean, we have a steering group for our employee communities called The Collective, which is made up of the leaders of the different communities that we have. So we have Unite, which is focused on LGBTQIA, Roots, which is focused on ethnic minority, Forward, which is focused on disability and neurodiversity, and then a women's group as well. And like I said, they're all so different. So for example, like, I know that Lucy and Lekka right now, who lead our women's group, are very busy overseeing some brilliant activities and discussions amongst our female leaders for International Women's Day next week. And Gabby leads our Roots community, has led a phenomenal program of like cultural and education events that celebrate the different ethnic backgrounds that make up the workforce of the agency. Matt and Hamish, who lead our Forward group, have been spending time with leadership on accessibility in the building and reasonable adjustments for people who are disabled or neurodiverse members of the agency. And Unite, which I lead with my colleague Rachel, has been focused really on representation within the creative work that the AND Partnership makes for its clients, which is something that I'm really proud of about the AND Partnership. I mean, we've been working on representation through the work and also creating campaigns that speak to issues that the community care about, such as last year we created a campaign for a number of LGBT charities to call on the government to ban conversion therapy. And, you know, that's something that we're really proud of and that's come out of that community, out of the Unite community. And another example is helping the agency to win the Channel 4 Diversity in Advertising competition this year for one of our clients, E45. So each of them is different. All their goals are different and what's important, but they're all led by what's important to the people within those communities.
No, that's really interesting. And I want to come back to some of those points, delve into those campaigns. But Russ, I just wanted to ask you, I know you mentioned very briefly earlier policy change. I'd love to know how the policy change came about from your community and the kind of steps to kind of getting that passed and actually changing the, was it parental leave parental policy?
So we've had two policy changes that we've affected. So when we first got together in a room and did a workshop and, you know, talked about the different things that, and the different challenges, I guess, that the parents have. The first one that came out really strongly was it's very difficult in the school holidays to, you know, to juggle, you know, childcare, your children being off, you know, you might have to drop or collect at strange times of day if they're at clubs. So the first thing that we did, which was a couple of years ago, we got it's called a schools out policy. So parents are allowed to work, they have to work 70% of core hours, and then that 30% of time could be spent at any time. So either that's early morning, evenings. So basically give you that kind of flexibility, which was fantastic. We also said that you didn't have to come into the office, you know, unless you had very specific meetings. So that was the first policy. That was quite easy to get through. The second one, you know, which has been a huge achievement, I think, and actually, I'd say it's probably one of the proudest moments. When this got signed off, I think it's probably one of the proudest moments I've had at work in the last sort of 20 years. Because I never really kind of expected to make a change that would actually positively influence kind of people's lives effectively. So, and it started about a year ago, so it's quite a long journey. But I had three people come and sit down and say, Russ, can I grab you for a coffee? And I think, come back to my initial point, I think that's where it's interesting, because historically they'd have always gone to HR.
Well, yeah, that's
but they didn't. Yeah, so, you know, they came to me, and HR only got involved probably a month or two later. So they came to me, you know, with some kind of research, and they said, look, we've looked at our parental leave, you know, it's poor. At the time it was 12 weeks. They'd looked at other agencies, other clients, other agencies within the Omnicom group that we're in, and, you know, literally just had a sort of leaderboard almost, and we were kind of quite close to the bottom of it. So we kind of got together and thought, right, how do we actually make this kind of happen? So between us, we kind of approached it a bit like a sort of client brief. So we kind of built a business case for it. So we looked at, we did our sort of all the data and the research to look at where we stood. We looked at the cost implications. So if you change it from, you know, 12 weeks to 26 weeks, what would that mean? We looked at, you know, the potential, you know, reasons why people leave the business as well. So actually, are people leaving because of the 12 weeks and actually the cost of actually replacing those people? So yeah, we did it very kind of thoroughly. We got, you know, then the kind of SLT involved, and we had just a really nice sort of deck that just went to them and almost just proved the case to make it happen.
How many weeks were you pushing for from 12 to...
So we had two scenarios. So we had three scenarios at one point, but actually we thought, let's simplify this and just go, what do we actually want? Because if you go to what you want, they might kind of push you back. But if you go, here's 26 and here's 18, so it's 12 at the moment, we're thinking 18, 26.
Yeah.
But you thought, if you go for 18, sorry, finance people, yeah. they'll probably go for 18. So actually went to 26, that's what we want. Try not to kind of budge, if you like. We also have 6 weeks return to work pay as well if you've been in the company 3 or more years. Mm-hmm. So it's just really a case of kind of sitting and waiting as to what they were going to go with. So yeah, earlier this year, they decided that they would move to 26 weeks. So that was effective from the 1st of January. Some of the people that spearheaded this actually are going to benefit from it now, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But I've just, people that, again, that I didn't know in the business have kind of come up and like personally thanked me, which is like strange. It's just like, it's amazing. So I can now start, you know, my maternity leave earlier. I've been mm-hmm. really struggling, you know, with tiredness and getting into the office. I can start 2 weeks early, or people saying I can take a full year off now. I was only going to take 6 months off. So, you know, when you're doing something that is really kind of impacting someone's life, at such a, you know, having been through that myself, it's such a big, you know, life stage change that, it's really rewarding.
Really,
yeah, it has been.
It's funny, it's reminding me of like a union or something. Do you know what I mean? Like teachers' unions getting together and then they're striking and then this happens. This feels like a kind of low-key version of that.
Yeah. No? I'm very popular with all the mums-to-be.
Oh, I can imagine! Our hero! No, that's great. And... well, yeah, just really interesting and actually seeing kind of that concrete policy change that changes people's lives, which is amazing. And I think that's what happens when you get people who can push for these kind of things in positions of power, I guess, or, you know, high up positions. And that's their self-interest as well as other people's. David, I wanted to ask you about your community, Unite, which has grown beyond your agency. I kind of want to know, how did this happen?
Yes. So Unite was an idea I had back in 2019 to create a larger connected community for LGBTQIA people from across the different agencies of WPP, like Essence MediaCom, Wavemaker Grey, etc., etc. All of those agencies that are in that group are the different shapes, different sizes. They all strut to a different tune. They got a different culture. They're all wonderfully different and interesting.
Mm.
But they all had one thing in common, which was that within each of them, there were groups of people, or sometimes just individuals, who were really passionate about making their agencies spaces where queer people could thrive and feel confident using their roles and the positions that we have as shapers of advertising and media and comms to improve the representation of LGBTQIA people out in society. But a lot of people I noticed were actually getting a bit burned out by the process. Trying to run committees, organise talks, training, events for their agency, representing the voice of their community. And I thought, hang on, I think we can probably all do this a bit better. And why aren't we thinking like what we actually are, which is one community? So at the beginning of 2020, we began to approach it a bit like we would a client brief, really. We wrote ourselves a brief. We organised a series of workshops to bring together about representation from about 25 different WPP agencies or different parts of the WPP business, and organised ourselves into work streams to define like a coherent strategy. We whipped ourselves up a really tasty visual identity. We pitched a creative vision for the growth of Unite back to WPP central leadership and then to the agency leaders as well. And Unite was born. And I mean, I'm really proud of that. It's something I'm personally very proud of that I've done with a lot of really brilliant people who just saw the potential with it and have just thrown their influence or their creativity or their skills behind growing it. And what's brilliant now is that it's a network which spans the agencies of WPP. So there's, you know, Grey Unite, Wavemaker Unite, the AMP Partnership Unite, Burton Unite. And it's also live in multiple different markets now. It's scaled up to countries like Singapore, Belgium, India, North America. So it's something that across the wider WPP network, people have seen a structure that they can grab onto and can evolve to make work for their agencies, which is great. And then in 2022, I think it was, it won Best Overall Employee Network at the British Diversity Awards, which I'm really proud of.
Yeah, very good. No, that's great. And I kind of wanted to talk a bit about like how Unite worked on the campaign for London Pride's 50th anniversary. How did this come about?
Well, we approached Pride. I can't remember if we approached Pride or if Pride approached us. Can't remember. But
say Pride approached you.
There was a meeting of minds around their 50th anniversary. And I mean, there was a feeling from the queer community that Pride had been losing its spirit of protest in the face of increased commercialisation. And
interesting.
And Pride were looking for a partner to help them shape what their point of view should be for that historic 50th year since the first ever Pride March. And we thought, look, rather than just advise you, just give us the entire job. Like the media, the creative, the PR, the design, everything. And we will give you the world's first ever totally queer powered campaign. Wow. What's really interesting about it is that every facet of the campaign, from client services to strategy to booking the rooms for meetings to creative development and direction, production, design, media planning and buying, PR, it was all created by queer employees from across the different agencies who all came together as one WPP Unite team. And we felt it was important because we wanted to create something that genuinely felt reflective of how the community feels about 50 years of marching with Pride and what the next 50 years should look like. So it was, you know, it was a bit of an exhausting process. Yeah. I think pro bono campaigns always are, but it was a brilliant experience. And the work that came out of it really reflected how much the community felt about Pride. The campaign was called All Our Pride. And at the heart of it was this phenomenal manifesto, which was written by two Unite members, Bea Pankey and Jamie June Hill, which is probably one of the best pieces of writing I've seen in years. And it just had fantastic execution in out of home. The design was great. It was great. So do look it up. Check it out on the Unite Instagram account, anybody who is scrolling.
A little shout out. Yeah, I'll put it in the link, I think, so people can check it out. And what was the reception to this campaign?
Really positive.
Yeah.
I can't remember off the top of my head now, but we had obviously been doing tracking against it and measuring perception shift. And I think it was one of the first times that perception had switched into quite a sharp spike of positivity, which was great. There's also some really satisfying nuggets around the campaign. Like it was the largest Pride march in history, that 50th anniversary. Wow. So it was such an honour and a great thing that it was our campaign which was wrapped around that. And seeing your work.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. And I think for a lot of the queer people, particularly the young queer people who'd worked on it, seeing their work up on Piccadilly Circus and all over London, and it was great. It was really great.
It was amazing. For those who haven't seen the campaign, could you just describe, like, for instance, like an out of home that will have been in Piccadilly or...
Oh, gosh. So, for example, the out of home was, we had taken historic images of old Pride marches and blended them with more modern photography from the community. So you couldn't quite tell what was past and what was present.
Yeah.
And then overlaid onto this beautiful imagery were the different colours of the different LGBTQIA flags.
Yeah.
So what the creative team had done was dissect what those colours are and woven them into different executions. So there wasn't like one out of home. I think we had about 20 different variants. Wow.
Mm.
And each of them was focused on real representation from the people who were in the out of home were then reflected in the colours of the flag that was broken down. And I'm not explaining it very well.
It sounds great. Amazing.
Yeah. Really good.
It sounds amazing. And it's interesting, I think both of you picked up on the fact that when you've kind of proposed an idea within these groups, you've kind of thought of it as a client brief.
Yeah.
Do you think the reason, and I actually don't know about other industries, but why ERGs are so successful within advertising is because you are in advertising, as in you've got your client briefs or not?
I have a little feeling that yes. Because I think that as an industry, it doesn't matter if you're on the media side of it or the creative side of it, I think you get personal satisfaction from knowing that you are actually creating something that has some kind of tangible output.
Mm-hmm.
I know it could be like, I mean, my grandmother still calls me whenever she sees one of my ads on the telly.
No, really?
But it's that for me, since I've been like 21, has been a little like, oh, I love being in this industry because my nan calls me when she sees something I've made. And I know, you know, whether you, like I said, work in media and you're planning a campaign, or whether you're in the creative side or in comms and PR, I mean, I think everyone gets a bit of satisfaction from seeing the output.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you apply that mindset and that approach and that level of creativity to something like employee communities, I think we as an industry become very good at defining them, branding them, shaping them, giving them clear purpose and objectives, ensuring they've got great output. So yes, I think so.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting that you both said that.
I was going to say, no, I probably approached it because I'm very like, data focus. So I was just like, oh, we need a business case. We need numbers and data in it. But I think, I think coming back to what you're saying about sort of ERGs and importance in advertising, I was actually reading an IPA paper the other day, you're pleased to know. And it looked at the composition of advertising agencies and actually comparing them to other industries. And they are, you know, relatively sort of diverse and, you know, generally sort of have a much younger demographic, obviously myself excluded from that. But it is quite a sort of diverse and young demographic. And I think the nature of the work that we do, particularly if it is kind of, you know, out at home or big advertising, I think it really requires us to think about sort of diversity and intersectionality. So, you know, I've been working in the industry for like 20 plus years now. And I think, you know, if you rewind sort of 10 to 15 years ago, you know, an advert would have featured a certain type of family composition. So it would have been traditionally a mum and a dad and two kids or a husband and a wife. And so I think thankfully, you know, that's not the case today. And, you know, we've moved away from that. And I think, you know, for everyone in the advertising industry to think about, you know, be thinking about this and the diversity and actually how we can kind of weave that into our work, I think is really important.
Totally agree with that. I have been on a personal vendetta throughout my career. I have been shoving gay people in ads for about 10 years, and I think people have finally noticed that that's what I've been doing consistently.
Well, do you think that having these ERGs actually changes the creative output of your work in this exact way, because you have people kind of able to voice their beliefs and opinions and perspectives and feel like they're given a voice within these different groups? Are you seeing a change within creative output?
You're more creative for me, so I
don't think that one up. Obviously, I saw it with your...
I think, yes, to an extent, but I do have a few cautionary tales about that and going all in on it entirely, because I think lived experience is incredibly valuable, but it needs to be coupled with genuine marketing experience, or, you know, how we're defining ourselves, campaign development experience or whatever. Because I think the question of how do you make the output of your agency's work more diverse and reflective of society is more complicated than just, you know, shove more queer people into it, for example. I think, so I think lived experience is incredibly valuable, and anybody who works in an agency where somebody is generous enough to share that on what your output might be, it's incredibly valuable. But you also need to balance that with, like, what is right for the brand, what is right for the campaign, what is right for the audience. So it is a bit of a halfway house. So I'm neither one way or the other when it comes to that. I think it's about a blend of both.
Definitely. No, it's interesting. And just kind of to finish up, because we're getting to the end of our conversation, how would you advise agencies who might be at the beginning of their journey, as in starting out these communities in their agencies, or individuals who don't currently have any, what would you advise them to do?
I would say just kind of start small and grow. I think trying to do everything in one fell swoop is not the right way to do it. I think it will...
Can't all be you.
No. I think it would just come across as quite inauthentic if you try and do that, and I think it does take time to evolve, so, you know, it just wouldn't work. So I think actually kind of growing it organically, seeing people seeing the benefit of it, everything kind of becoming, I guess, just, you know, common language in the business as well. And I think, you know, the other thing, I don't know if this kind of weaves into that or not, but you kind of want to get that point across that, you know, when we do have these conversations, we have what we call kind of curiosity labs, and that would be someone talking about, so we had, you know, one of the strategists talking about, you know, ADHD is his superpower, and then we had someone else talk about the challenges they have being bipolar. We had someone talk about challenges of mental health because they lost their mum, and I think, you know, again, I don't think those sort of things would have happened, you know, before we had this, and people are prepared to kind of talk about these really tough topics and kind of be just really vulnerable and share their kind of, I think you mentioned the word, like, lived experiences as well. And, you know, just doing those things, if it means that someone then goes and talks to that person, go, look, I'm suffering as well, you know, let's have a chat, meet up for a coffee. I think all those things are, you know, how it comes across. And those are the kind of conversations for me that I think ERGs, you know, really start to make a difference in
people's lives.
I think that's a great answer. I think my piece of advice would be, what are you really trying to do and who are you doing it for? I think you need to define what you're trying to achieve and who ultimately it benefits. Like, why, really interrogate, why are you doing it? Is it for the culture of the agency? Is it to influence the output of the agency? Is it to create a sense of belonging? Is it to have a line of advocacy to senior leadership? I think without that definition and really clear objectives, I would say it's easy for employee communities to just kind of float and then fall apart because they haven't got a thing that's driving them forward. I think Unite worked because it was an idea that moved ERGs on from being about just about employees educating one another and others in the agency by running events to being a platform for queer people to channel their efforts and their skills and their creativity towards things that they cared about. So yes, that might be an event or a talk, or it might be going out there and doing a pro bono campaign for a charity, but it could also be a direct line to senior leadership, or it could be a means of tapping into the resources of the company to create something on a topic that the community care about, like Russell's talked about with this policy change for parents. So I think that would be my thing, is just be really clear on why are you doing it and who is it for.
No, that's really great advice from both of you. But thank you so much. That was a really interesting discussion. It was great to have you both on. And yeah, that was IPA on Industry Matters with David Adamson and Russ Greenbridge. Thank you.
Thank you.